This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
This is Lily Gorin with the New Books Network, the New Books and Political Science podcast. Today, I'm joined by Andy Hom, who is author of International Relations and the Problem of Time. This book was published in 2020 by Oxford University Press and takes us through the question of time, which is not a small question, and how international relations in particular should be paying a lot of attention to questions of time and temporality. But I'm going to let Andy talk to us a little bit about that. First, I'd like to welcome Andy Hom to the podcast and ask him to tell us a little bit about himself and how he came to this really interesting project. Hi, Andy.
Hi, Lily. Thanks very much for having me on.
Sure. Tell us a little about yourself and how you came to the question of time in international relations.
So I'm a senior lecturer at the University of Edinburgh in the Department of Politics and International Relations. And before that, I worked around Scotland at various universities after completing my PhD at the University of Aberystwyth. I came to this topic. I guess I need to go a bit further back to talk about how I came to this topic. The short story is that it's sort of Brent Steele's fault. He was my master's advisor at the University of Kansas even further back when I was in the process of switching careers or switching from a failed career into graduate school, and I told him I wanted to work on either sovereignty or time, and he very wisely said, there's a lot of work on sovereignty, but not a lot of work on time, so why don't you think about the second one and come back and tell me what you have to say. And then I read Rob Walker's 1993 book, Inside Outside, which is, I think a lot of people have found it quite provocative, and I certainly did as well, and I guess in some ways it's also his fault, although I don't know that he knows that. But I've been sort of just chewing on this idea ever since. Once you start looking for time, or maybe I should say time is, it's sort of there, but it's hiding in plain sight. And so it's very easy to do IR or to think about politics without thinking explicitly about time. But as I've discovered, once you start looking for it, you know, it's everywhere. But the ways in which we use it tend to change quite a bit. So they have some important commonalities, which I tried to sort of foreground in the book so that it would hang together and be cohesive. But there's also a lot of variety in the ways that political scientists or IR scholars think about and depend on and end up using time in their work. And it turns out there's also an even probably wider variety of the ways that time impacts actual international politics out there in the world, so to speak.
And one of the points that you make throughout the book, but certainly in framing the thesis, is that this is particularly important and particularly understudied, it seems, in international relations. Can you talk a little bit about specifically with regard to international relations as opposed to, say, political science broadly?
Sure. So, I agree with you, Lily. There's been a lot of work, probably stretching a bit further back, especially in political theory, on time. There's also, you know, a lot of the things that make their way into IR, especially sort of American Academy IR, tend to come in through political science. So, for instance, there's a chapter in the book on historical institutions, and it seems to my, you know, non-expert reading of disciplinary history that we see historical institutions a little bit earlier in political science than in IR. It's a bit strange because, again, once you start looking at IR directly, there's just a lot of time or temporal concerns going on. Just a few that, you know, that I mentioned early on in the book. I mean, when we talk about whether it's foreign policy or national security or grand strategy, and whether the election of a new leader signals continuity or change in those elements, you know, that's a temporal question, continuity versus change. We also see a lot of talk about linear versus cyclical conceptions of history. So is history, you know, kind of steady onwards and upwards progress, or is it more of a recurrent, say, balance of power politics or security dilemmas if you're working within structural realism? The way that the discipline of IR has evolved as well, and it may be more the way it understands itself to have evolved than the full story of the field and in the discipline's history. But the standard story about the evolution of international relations, you know, includes key moments like the sort of shocking slaughter of the Great War, or World War I, the thermonuclear revolution, then 50 years or so where it's just stability and structure, or so we hear, then the end of the Cold War, which surprised everyone, then 9/11, then latterly the global financial crisis and the Arab Spring. So there's this kind of structure, I think, that's highly temporalized in the discipline's self-understanding, which is that we have models and we're working on those models, and all of a sudden a kind of an exogenous or external shock in the world of international politics upends everything we thought we knew. And then there's a fair amount of sort of teeth gnashing or self-reflection or blame in some of these episodes. And then the discipline, to some extent, reinvents itself and tries to move forward in light of these new events. So that kind of, you know, stability or continuity, crisis and change, that's almost impossible to understand without time and temporality. So these are some of the things that I think are kind of, again, hiding in plain sight in the discipline.
And that's one of the things that I found really fascinating is the way that you sort of say, hey, think about this. You've never thought about this, but if you think about it, it's everywhere. And I know that Elizabeth Cohn, who's another scholar of sort of political time, said sort of the same thing in her book, that once you start to see it and think about it, that it is, in fact, structurally everywhere. And so I wanted to ask you, what is it that we mean by this idea of time, which itself is an abstraction? Because you also distinguish time from timing and a theory, a basic theory of timing. So can you give us a broader discussion of these distinctions and what we're talking about?
So the question, what do we mean by time, is you can have centuries of philosophy on this and decades of social theory. And it's, you know, it's a question with no end in some ways. It means something different to everyone. We all tend to share a number of ideas about what time is. And so I think the book tries to not skirt that question, but to kind of dissolve the question a little bit. So a lot of those, again, the centuries of philosophy and decades of social theory, they've been trying for the most part to identify, you know, a sort of a stable kernel or a universal truth or a metaphysical condition that makes time real, right? And often then they distinguish between that kind of absolute or metaphysical or natural time, and then all of the hurly-burly experiences of time that subjective, you know, unreliable, internally changing humans tend to have. And so there's already a kind of a value hierarchy imposed in the way we think about time, which is that there's something out there that's real time and that doesn't change. And then everything that you and I think about with our time perception, I mean, you know, the sort of lockdown and the COVID, the year of COVID, What we're hearing about a lot is that none of us remember what month it is, much less what day, and that time is either passing very slowly or very quickly. And those tend to all get lumped into the psychological perception of time as something less real than this supposedly freestanding natural fact. And the book's argument is there is no natural fact. It's all just built up from various social experiences of time. But the importance of timing, which I'll try to define or kind of elaborate a little bit more shortly, but the importance of timing is the argument of timing is that those social experiences of time are things that we've gone out of our way to create. And we've often gone out of our way to create or construct various experiences or symbols of time for political purposes. And so then what we come to understand as real in 2020 is usually resting on decades, if not centuries, of widely shared, increasingly global social practices of timing. And again, by timing, I mean much more than coincidence or just when something happens, right? So we often will kind of idiomatically say, oh, this is really good or really bad timing, right? If you run into your friend on the street right before you're about to, you know, go for a drink, that's great timing. Come with us. Or if, you know, if the letter arrives the day after you needed to submit it as evidence, for something, then it's bad timing. Timing in the book is based more on Norbert Elias's very brief sociological or social theoretical essay on time. And it's the idea that timing is a much more kind of comprehensive or synthetic social activity where we are trying to stitch together various processes and changes and actors, and relations. We're trying to stitch together all these dynamic elements that matter, and we're trying to make them sort of hang together and interact in ways so that they unfold new processes that wouldn't otherwise be there. And those processes make social life more intelligible. Ideally, they make it more meaningful. And even more ideally, they sort of become useful processes that we can help to organize, again, our lives together, or perhaps to organize, if you look further back in history, the rotation of crops, or the planting of crops against the seasonal cycles. So there are all these sorts of kind of huge, complex, and widely shared activities that count as timing. And we just have kind of forgotten that because we tend to talk much more about time than timing.
And part of what you're talking about here is that there's really this question also of narrative. And I was recently talking with Roger Smith about his new book, which also is kind of this question of how do we apply a narrative to understand the world around us? And part of what you're talking about is that there's a narrative of timing that I think is really interesting and helps human brains, sort of compartmentalize and make sense of things. Can you explain a little bit about this idea of the narrative?
Yes. So I think narrative theorists would probably take issue with this. But to me, narrative is almost a subset or a really important type of timing. So if timing activities, for something to count as a timing activity, it just needs to stitch together social relations or processes in a new way and help them unfold towards a different outcome. Narrative would be one key way that we do that. But we might also do things that are entirely technical, like inventing and developing and perfecting a mechanical clock. But narratives, I mean, one thing that I think narrative theorists tend to agree on is that, not unlike time, once you start looking for the basic features of narratives, protagonists and antagonists, plot twists, chronological endings that also kind of neatly tie up all of the meaning of the story. Once you start to look for those elements, you also start to see narratives everywhere in social life. So much more than the kind of the classic, at least in political science, narrative versus theory divide, it might actually be more like theories are a type of narrative, and the ways in which we engage, politics and the ways we try to understand them in both political science and international relations are highly narrativized. I mean, what theory doesn't, posit some sort of protagonist or antagonist, doesn't start somewhere and end somewhere, doesn't choose its ending in a way that is really useful for making, kind of tying up all of the elements that it's been working with. you know, and it tends to follow something like a plot arc, although it may not be as exciting as a tragic plot arc from Greek drama. You know, it does tend to kind of follow twists and turns that it makes intelligible as it leads toward that conclusion.
And in this context, you talk about the fact that for IR in particular, that there's a role for narrative timing that connects to these theories as well. And also because there are these sort of broad discussions of cyclical or linear sort of activities and theories, that this is really where time and timing come in to IR in a particular way. Can you talk a little bit about that?
So, yes, I hope I can. Let me organize my thoughts a bit. You know, timing, the way the book introduces timing is quite general or basic. And so then it needs, the argument, I think, or the discussion needs to begin focusing in a little bit more on the kind of raw material that we tend to think about international relations scholars working with. And that's either theories or researches, you know, into international politics. And so narrative theory helps us get there, again, because if we understand these basic elements of narrative, then almost anything that we write about international politics, even the most formal game theoretical model, tends to have some exposition, a header behind it that adds qualitative content. And even the model itself, right? I mean, we have inputs and we have perhaps, let's say, you know, decision nodes and then outputs. So there is a kind of a narrative temporality to that, right? There's a beginning and an end, and the end is important. I realize that's a really basic conceptual narrative, but I'm trying to, in the first part of the book, I'm trying to work in the most basic sense or with the most basic elements so that we can have a kind of a set of tools for the second part of the book where I look at specific parts of international relations scholarship, but using a tool that can kind of be adapted and, you know, fit for purpose in each different chapter. You know, you mentioned linear and cyclical again, and I've mentioned continuity and change. If we look at international relations, again, without those two binaries or tensions or questions about the ways in which international politics is unfolding, again, without notions about crisis and shocks and adaptation, all of which, again, we can kind of clearly see playing a narrative role in the stories we construct about politics and also the stories the field tells about itself as a field that tends to adapt to surprising changes. If we take those out, which I understand to be narrative timing elements, it's really hard to imagine what IR would look like without them. I mean, we might talk about organizing principles like anarchy, perhaps, but then it turns out that anarchy gets very frequently conflated with chaos. This is There was an interesting article by Jack Donnelly, I think, on this a few years back in International Theory, showing how often we move from kind of anarchy as the formal absence of a sovereign or a hegemonic power and into the idea of anarchy as kind of easily leading to chaos and disorder. Well, chaos and disorder are two of the longest running associates, if you will, of the problem of time, at least in the Western philosophical tradition. So again, even when we start looking at things that may not be clearly kind of dynamic narrative elements or elements that change over time, it turns out that they have temporal assumptions built into them.
And you, in the beginning of the book, you talk a bit about the Western conception of time, and I'm taking you back a little bit. I'm sorry about that, but I wanted you to talk a little bit about this sort of question of how time is, or the absence of time is considered to some degree to be chaotic, and that the presence of time is a form of ordering, and that we've seen this sort of organizing over centuries in the West in terms of our understanding of our lives, which goes to this question of narrative as well. But can you talk just a little tiny bit about why the absence of time may be this sort of question of chaos and disruption? And we've become so used to the sort of structure and organizing sort of understanding of time in our lives.
The Western conception of time that we have now, I think if we start looking at it more closely, it threatens to fall apart. It seems to have an internal contradiction that just can't hold, which is that temporal symbols or time reckoning devices like standardized clock, right, or the Gregorian calendar, or the idea of time as progress, tend to sit side by side with much older ideas about time as the bringer of dissolution and decay and chaos. And so, you know, the internal contradiction there is, how can you have this one very short word or concept that's supposed to, you know, throw its arms around both, you know, the bringer of chaos on the one hand and the kind of the arch symbol of eternal order, like the clock, on the other. The way that I'm kind of arguing that we should resolve that, again, is to understand the more kind of stable and orderly versions of time as solutions to this older tradition. So the introduction to the book begins a little bit further back than a lot of IR books begin, which is in sort of pre-classical Middle East or Near East, looking very briefly at the idea that there are, in these kind of ancient cosmologies, there are these ancient time gods, and the time gods are reliably the antagonists of the gods who sit in heaven or the gods who reside in eternity. And these time gods, one of which is actually called Time the Destroyer, so that's a sort of very nice synopsis, they're given dominion over Earth, and they become one of the first explanations for why so many human projects tend to fall apart, right? Or are so hard to kind of stitch together and maintain. That makes its way into classical Greek philosophy, and from there into sort of Roman and Christian philosophy and theology. And of course, then you get the kind of the Western tradition is off and running. And it's really, you know, it's baked deeply into the pie by that point, that things that are temporal, and for anyone who has kind of experience in religious education or in the church, you know, things that are temporal are opposed to things that are eternal. But it's not just that we die, whereas God and eternity remain or last, but it, you know, temporal also means sinful, right? Or kind of fallen. So there's that ancient kind of dichotomy just doing a lot of work. And then Western philosophy, which then generates political philosophy and eventually political theory, you know, that orientation where we need to find stable elements that will solve the natural tendency of things toward disorder and chaos, because we live in a temporal realm rather than an eternal realm, that inflects, so, you know, I don't want to say everything in Western political thought, but it's certainly the dominant tradition. This is the kind of thing that John Pocock and John Gunnell, have highlighted, along with Sheldon Wolin and more laterally, you know, Elizabeth Cohen, who you mentioned, and several other sort of contemporary political theorists.
And you sort of use this we take for granted, shall we say, understanding of time, and then you do unpack it in terms of understanding both time and the basic theory of timing. And you structure your book in two sections. And the first section, as you say, is kind of laying out the basis of kind of understanding IR, how it works. And the second section is more particular with regard to exact theories within IR. Can you talk about why you structured it this way in particular and what it opened up for you in terms of the research itself?
I ask myself that a lot, drafting and redrafting and revising stages, Lily. So it's a good question. I'm not sure I've ever adequately answered it to myself, but the reason that it's structured the way it is, or I think for the readership, is twofold. One is that by the time when I started working on the book, you know, it was a PhD project, and it was 2009, and it was still a kind of you had to do a bit of salesmanship to get people to think about or listen about time and international politics, due to the kind of vagaries of post PhD job hunting and all those other dynamics that were at play. There was a bit of a delay, and by the time I was pitching it as a book, it was no longer difficult to get people to listen about time. There have been a kind of a swell of work, really fascinating, excellent work on a variety of international political elements about time. Millennium, the journal that's run at the LSE, had done an entire annual conference on the politics of time. And so at that point then, what I felt was still missing in the IR research on time was an effort to spell out a distinctively international social theoretical kind of foundation for thinking about time. We'd borrowed a lot and done so very well from other theories. And I borrow from Elias, so there's, you know, nothing's created out of nothing. But, you know, I wanted to kind of take a little bit longer to develop a theory that was kind of international political through and through, but could also then be used to do things beyond what the book itself does. So as you mentioned, the second part of the book is looking resolutely inward, so to speak, at international relations scholars and their practices and the works that they produce. But I wanted the first part to reflect, I think, a bigger gamble or a bigger wager of timing theory, which is that you can use timing theory to unpack, to identify and unpack and analyze almost any time or temporal symbol that we find out in the world, whether that be the world of the academy or the world of, you know, political practice or social life. And so I wanted to kind of highlight that, set them apart. So part one, you know, I think probably has wider or more general applicability beyond the world of IR theory. And part two, again, is trying to cash out those insights specifically inside of IR.
And so in that section of the book, and you've got a nice group of chapters here, you go through different kinds of approaches and understandings that you sort of outline how time and timing theory has operated. Can you talk a little bit about, nobody has their favorite child, but which might be the most interesting to you as you were writing the work itself? In terms of seeing and understanding the application of the timing theory within these particular IR zones?
I would never admit to having a favorite child, having two of my own. So if I can swerve that question just slightly, Lily, if I could say something
sure.
I particularly appreciate about each child. Maybe that would be better. So the second part of the book goes through disciplinary history, methodologies, quantitative IR, historical institutionalism, and critical IR. So one thing to say is I was trying to kind of cast a wide net there. It certainly is not exhaustive of all the places you can find scholarship on time or temporal scholarship on international relations, but I was trying to kind of, you know, not just resolutely stay in one lane. Disciplinary history, the thing that I found fascinating as I was going through these kind of classic stories about IR theories confronting shocking events and then trying to adapt was that it was the very kind of basic structure that narrative theorists say that narrative helps us grapple with when we confront temporal chaos. We construct new narratives that restore the kind of inhabitable time of life, so time that seems like a manageable realm in which we can move and act. This is exactly what we see, IR scholars doing after the Great War, after the thermonuclear revolution and the end of the Cold War, and then latterly 9/11. In the methodological chapter, I wasn't looking at specific methods or techniques so much as looking at the what other scholars have called the hookup between our knowledge and the world. So what do we think the world is made of, and what does that imply about how we can come to know things about the world? And there it was quite striking to discover that, you know, King, Cohen, and Verba's methodology book is probably, I haven't surveyed graduate programs, but still seems to be the dominant work on methodology, especially in mainstream political science. And it's got, and I don't mean this in a pejorative sense, it's more a remark of admiration. It's got, the whole thing hangs on a certain element of science fiction and time travel. Which is an interesting, I think, tension or an interesting twist on the way that the book understands itself or the way that the methodology presents reliable social science. But what they're often saying is, you know, in social life, unlike in the lab, we can't go back in time, right? So in the lab, if you're trying to understand gravity, you just pick the ball up off the floor and you roll it off the table over and over again, right? So you can essentially restart sort of the time of this experiment over and over until you understand what's happening. But we can't do that in social life. And so what they often, the solution they propose for causal inference is to imagine that, you know, there's one passage where they say, imagine that we put a person in prison for 20 years and then we find out whether he's radicalized. And then we go back in time and put the same person in university and let him go on to have a career. And then we can try to figure out whether he is also, you know, also becomes radicalized or not. So, you know, this is then the question for the rest of that discussion for them is, how can we operationalize that sort of imaginary experimental setup? Because we can't do it in real life. It's unethical to send people to prison just to see what happens to them. So how do we operationalize that in our social scientific research designs? And so for me, you know, this was a fascinating kind of aha moment, which was, it's the science fiction of time travel that makes neo-positivist or mainstream kind of, you know, unity of science causal inference possible in social life. So, you know, that again is, that's something that I sort of found particularly interesting in researching and writing that chapter. Moving on to sort of the quantitative and the other chapters, you know, one thing is that the sort of, we pay a lot of attention. So I kind of straddled, this is a bit of backstory, I straddled the sort of divide between UK and US training, and that I had a lot of graduate training in the political science program at Kansas, where I did my master's, and then a very different type of graduate training at Aberystwyth. But one thing that, you know, just seemed to be common across them is that there is training in statistics. And now how much you get depends a lot on where you go to graduate school. There's not a lot of history of statistics. And once we start looking at the history of statistics, for me, this was kind of Ian Hacking's Taming of Chance and several other more recent works. There's a lot of narrative, sort of almost poetic attempts to devise concepts that help us resolve or kind of grapple with the idea that, you know, this is in the 17th, 18th, 19th century, that God is dead, or you can't rely on God or eternity to sort of explain why things happen. So we need the law of large numbers, and we need the kind of the normal distribution to reassure us that although this one thing we're looking at might be very random, over time, enough of these similar things will happen that it will all even out. So it was, again, this kind of, for me, an aha moment that there is a kind of a deep narrative temporality to even something as formal and as it's often called timeless, right? The linear regression model is seen to be the kind of the timeless workhorse of sort of frequentist statistics. But if we start kind of taking it apart, there's a really creative narrative temporality flowing through it. Okay, I'll try to be a bit quicker on the last two chapters. Historical institutions, you know, this is a much more recent research area in IR and one that excites me because it is coming out of perhaps a more mainstream political science tradition, but looking directly at time. But one of the things that was interesting, again, in reading more closely in that subfield was that there's still that problem of time tradition, as I call it in the book, lurking, you know, just behind all the kind of main action. You know, a lot of historical institutionalists are trying to explain why institutions endure well past their kind of best by date or well past the point where their original relevance or the kind of the mission for which they emerged has been completed. So why are institutions sticky? But also, why don't they adapt as quickly as, you know, as kind of rationalist models of institutional design would expect them to adapt? And the answer reliably is that temporal dynamics get in the way. And that's really interesting on its own terms, right? That the sort of passage of time or path dependence, you know, or the kind of various dynamics that drive stickiness, that these things tend to kind of confound our more rationalist expectations about institutions. But again, it's also, I think one of the reasons it's probably resonated is it's still partaking of that ancient tradition where if we simply say that time passes, it's not at all provocative to then say, and then things fall apart, right? Or time passes and our best hopes are confounded. So there's this kind of interesting dramatic element to the way historical institutionalism has come into IR that I think can be somewhat resolved or again dissolved if we understand and kind of pull out that problem of time tradition And so then I end up making an argument about how we might move from historical institutions where time is the reason that they tend to underperform our highest expectations, and we can move towards more dedicatedly temporal institutions where we just take that stickiness and that kind of slowness to adapt and the kind of what we often think of as the pathologies of institutions and say that's just the way that institutional life is. And we don't need to evaluate it either implicitly or explicitly against this kind of perfect, seamless, adaptive baseline. And then finally, the critical chapter is the one where I guess I, in some ways, worked to lose all my friends. Avarice, which is a fairly critically inclined graduate program or department. And that, you know, that is the kind of the field or the subfield that I identify mostly as, is as a kind of a lowercase c critical IR scholar. And critical scholars have been, you know, at the forefront or the vanguard of driving our interest in time and using a focus on time in international politics to expand the field's imagination about what counts as international politics and what actually goes into the kind of the ways that international politics unfolds. So, you know, I think that we wouldn't be anywhere near where we are now in discussing time in IR without critical IR. But there were a few things, you know, that just were nagging at me about that subfield, and perhaps none more than the kind of the discourse of rupture. This is often identified with post-structuralist IR, but that chapter, you know, tackles several different elements or several different ways in which critical scholars have thought about time and proposed it as an alternative way to theorize international relations, and tries to show that, you know, either the problem of time is still lurking once again, right? So at this deeply embedded kind of habit of thought is much harder to get rid of, right, or to undo than we might think. Or in the case of rupture, that there's actually, you know, that this is also its own disciplinary timing project, as much as I think theorists of rupture might wish to not, you know, to think differently. But the interest in the ways that ruptures undo hegemonic politics is almost always in hopes of a politics otherwise, which is Michael Shapiro's way of putting it, you know, or a less hegemonic, less violent political possibilities is what we in critical IR tend to think that ruptures will open onto. But there's a lack of elaboration about how we might actually get there. And there are strong post-structuralist reasons for not prescribing, you know, new programs of action. But the chapter kind of ends with a sustained critique of that for a while. You know, it may violate certain post-structuralist principles to prescribe a new program of action if we simply just say, we just hope that what happens after a rupture is better. You know, we're back to a kind of a classical realist problem, which is we need to act. You know, we need to have resources for action. If we leave it open to chance or open to all processes, then, you know, somebody else's will to power will exert itself and we may not like where we end up. So again, it's trying to show that in each of these different chapters, in each of these very, very different modes of doing IR or areas of IR research, there are efforts to time politics in certain ways that sort of reflect or comport with the scholars' methodological and often political commitments. Almost no one is trying to theorize ways in which to make nuclear war happen, for instance. We're all trying to theorize ways to prevent apocalypse. And but the ways in which we try to weave those commitments, again, methodological and political and theoretical, the way we weave those commitments into the arguments about what's actually happening in international politics or how we should study it has a really interesting kind of mimetic effect where we purport to be describing or unpacking the world, but we're actually also in part changing the world as we do it. And that's why, it's, you know, there's a kind of a continuum between scholarship as a form of timing and the kind of timing that we might actually see out in the world of politics.
And that's one of the things that I found really interesting about your research is that you are going in both directions in terms of understanding not only the sort of theory and IR and political theory obviously are built on this basis, but also what it is that we're thinking about in the world as events transpire, and how we sort of narrate them to ourselves to make sense out of them in terms of the theory. And I found that as somebody who has studied political theory to be really fascinating and useful. And so I wanted to ask you a bit about, you know, once you get to an understanding of time, which is complicated and possibly disruptive to one's reality, what do you look at next? What's your next project?
My next project. I guess my next project is to take the two-part organization of the book seriously and stop thinking about other IR scholars for a little bit and think a little bit more about international politics. And so maybe, you know, to go back to your earlier question, why has the book organized this way? I think in some ways it's also a spur to myself, right, to really take seriously the wider applicability of timing theory and actually look at some timing in practice, again, out in the world of politics. I mean, some of this has fallen into my lap since the book was at least in production. So it used to be just like it was a little bit hard to get people to think about time or listen to me talk about time in IR and political science. It was also, you had to do a little bit of hermeneutic work on your own to pull out the temporality of politics in the past. In the last 2 or 4 years, Lily, that has changed completely, which is that's a wonderful thing, but it's a little bit like drinking from the fire hose. but you've got everyone talking about crisis and the end times because of the election of Donald Trump. But even here in the UK, you know, the Brexit debates, the way they've unfolded since the resolution has just been shot through with talk about time. I mean, I said that IR is unimaginable without time. You couldn't have the Brexit debate as we know it without references to, you know, the ticking clock or running out the clock, without references to the cliff edge, which is the deadline, and what happens after the deadline is passed if we don't have a deal. Brexit has even created new time words like sequenceology, neverendums, which is a neologism, I think, for never and referendums. So neverendums and Brexternity. So you've got various actors on either side of the parliamentary aisle, so to speak, flinging these new time words as accusations against each other. So, you know, I guess politics did some of the work for me in that this stuff was unavoidable. And of course, COVID has not only rearranged our relationship to time, but there's talk about how many waves we're going to face and how long we'll be in lockdown. So this is duration and deadlines and processes. I've been trying to sort of show how those, you know, exemplify political timing at work. And I've done some really enjoyable work collaborating with Ryan Beasley at St. Andrews on this. Ryan Beasley is a foreign policy expert, and I am not. So he brings the foreign policy and I brought the timing, and, you know, we've managed to, I think, at least illustrate how important time is to Brexit, and we're hoping to do so with COVID. How long that stuff goes probably depends on funding and you know, I mean, hopefully the pandemic itself won't last much longer. Beyond that, I wanted to look at a particularly American form of time, something that, again, is I think uniquely important and kind of durable in the American experience, which is wartime. And this is building on, it's inspired by Mary Dudziak's book, which is largely kind of a legal analysis of the politics of, you know, when wars end and how long they can last. I'm hoping to kind of take the timing theory I've developed in this book and start looking at elements, you know, how do American politicians and publics construct the idea of wartime, and how does it become, or why does it become so central to the way the U.S. organizes not only its foreign relations, but also its domestic politics. This, of course, is informed by going to university and especially graduate school during the Forever War on Terror.
Which is another great title.
The Forever War on Terror?
Yeah.
I'm still thinking about the title for the project, so I'm taking all candidates at this point. But, you know, I guess the wager of timing theory is that anywhere we find a kind of a durable, meaningful reference to time exerting social or political impact, we can, if we look closely and use the tools that I've developed in the book, we can find an underlying kind of timing apparatus. And the apparatus doesn't have to be technical and scientific. It could be, you know, again, largely narrative and social. And I think, you know, I'm hoping that if we start looking at, if I look at wartime more closely, you know, that I'll be able to unpack that in the same way.
I think it's a fascinating project, and particularly when you think about the American system, which has this regularization of elections, which then give us a time structure of administrations that's somewhat distinct from parliamentary systems, where the election is not necessarily as sort of embedded in our structure of politics. I look forward to reading that book and having you talk about it on the New Books Network with me when it's finished.
Years away, Lily, at this point. But I mean, you know, you're absolutely right about elections. I mean, it's so much more, I think, explicitly syncopated in the U.S. Than in parliamentary systems like the U.K.'s. This is something I didn't really appreciate till moving over here. But the ways in which a sort of a hard 4-year election time schedule or timetable exerts effects on American politics. But then again, also the ways in which various politicians have found ways around that for the sake of making war, whether it's the, you know, the authorization for the use of military force, or the ways in which the wider war on terror gets constructed as requiring a kind of a permanent, you know, wartime footing, which of course builds on the Cold War's largely permanent wartime footing, or at least preparedness, permanent wartime preparedness. You know, this is, I think, a fascinating, in some ways, it's like a clash of times or timing regimes moving under the surface of American politics. So
yeah, that is amazing. And just starting to talk about it and the way that you are conceptualizing it, it really is very fascinating, given also how Americans think about, in narrative context, the impact of the wars, the Great War, World War II, and so forth, and where they show up in terms of our understanding of ourselves as a people and our heroic intentions.
Heroic so, and just, right?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Thank you, Andy, for joining me today to talk about international relations and the problem of time. This book was published in 2020 by Oxford University Press. I assume it is available at Oxford University Press's website. Do you have a brick and mortar store that has an online option that you would like to give a shout out to?
It's available on bookshop.org, which is the US and now the UK kind of alternative to large online retailers. So I sadly have been away from the US so long, I'm not aware of which brick and mortar booksellers have survived. But bookshop.org will donate some of the proceeds to local shops.
Great. Thank you, Andy Hom, for joining me today to talk about time and IR.
Thanks very much for having me. It was a pleasure.